questions.
You're listening to Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Ontario hospitals and pediatric physicians are being told to be on guard for symptoms of invasive group A strep. This is apparently after an increasing trend has been spotted in a memo that's been obtained by my colleagues at CTV News Toronto in late May. The provincial associate chief medical health officer said there's been an increase of cases reported in our province among all age groups, including children under the age of 18. Dr. Christopher Labos joins us now. He's a cardiologist and a medical writer with a degree in epidemiology. Hello, doctor.
Hello.
What is strep A?
So strep A is one variant of the streptococcus bacterium. Most people are familiar with it. It is the bacteria that causes strep throat. And so most of the time, many streptococcus species are just sitting around on surfaces living in our skin and don't cause us any problems. But if they infect you, if they get inside your system, they can cause a relatively mild infection like strep throat. But if it starts getting into deeper tissues and gets into your bloodstream, that's when it can cause an invasive infection. And that's when you can get very, very sick and possibly even die.
How do you get rid of it?
Antibiotics. I mean, honestly, this is not a difficult thing to treat if you treat it early. A short course of antibiotics essentially kills the bacteria and allows people to get better. We often see it in children. So when you have these outbreaks in schools and daycare centers, which sometimes happens, if you can get in there and treat everybody quickly, you stop the outbreak, because within 24 hours of getting antibiotics, you're, number one, going to start to get better. And number two, you're not going to be infectious and not going to spread it to other people. So it's really, there's a very simple solution. It's antibiotics. It's just that it requires people to get into contact with medical care promptly. And that's, in recent years, become increasingly difficult as more and more people don't have a family doctor, as emergency rooms become overwhelmed and all the problems that we've unfortunately become familiar with in the past little while.
How often is it antibiotic resistant, where the antibiotics don't work?
I mean, it can happen, and antibiotic resistance is becoming more and more of an issue. Most of these cases are not. But this is a problem that we are seeing, not just with streptococcus, but with all bacteria. So we're seeing more and more antibiotic-resistant germs out there. And this is why I think the issue of antibiotic stewardship, the idea of being circumspect with the use of antibiotics, is so important. So, you know, you don't want to prescribe antibiotics for everything under the sun, because frankly, most of the things that make people, and especially kids, sick are viral. But when you know it's a bacterial infection, as streptococcus is, that's when antibiotics are so important, because they do treat the infection. They get rid of it. This is, you know, the solution to the problem is it is that straightforward. It is a one word answer. It is antibiotics.
The most recent report is warning that this is an increasing trend, that we are spotting this since January. Why do you think there's been an uptick?
Well, that is the $64,000 question. I don't think anybody has a clear answer. I think there's a lot of potential theories out there. In fact, this is a bit of a global trend. And even if you go back even before January into the fall of last year, starting in the UK and then more or less everywhere, there was this real uptick of group A strep and sometimes invasive group A strep infections with people dying. At the time, I think a lot of it was attributable to the fact that kids were getting sick with everything. I mean, if you remember what the fall of 2022 looked like, it was, you know, something of a disaster in many pediatric hospitals. You had children getting COVID, children getting RSV, children getting influenza. And a lot of strep infections are secondary infections. We historically used to see it after chickenpox and influenza. We don't see as much chickenpox anymore because of the chickenpox vaccine, but it's not inconceivable to think that a lot of this was being driven by all the viral infections that were going on. It is a bit unusual that it's persisted this far into the season, because usually strep infections peak during the winter. They sort of follow what all the other viruses do. So it's a little bit unusual that it's still going on, and so that's why there might be other factors at play.
You talked about diagnosing strep early and catching it so that it doesn't really set in. It's a fairly simple thing to diagnose, isn't it? I mean, I think back to when I was younger, and I would get it when I was in middle school and elementary school, the telltale white spots on the tonsils when it feels like you're trying to swallow, but instead it feels like swallowing glass.
Yep. Yeah, and medically it's very straightforward. All you need is a throat swab, and many doctors and most urgent clinics can do it on the spot. You can get a rapid throat swab, and if it's positive for strep, you know what the diagnosis is and you treat it. So this is not a very difficult thing to treat, but it requires, number one, you know, people to seek medical care and for doctors to think of it. Now, neither of those things is particularly problematic, but it's important to sort of raise the issue to remind people of something, especially if you're seeing more and more of it. And, you know, also, I think this speaks to a much larger issue, which is, you know, we're very used to the idea, okay, when you're sick, you go to the emergency room. And there was a time when maybe that was okay, but given the strain we're putting on our healthcare system, we're going to have to find alternative models where we can outsource some of the less urgent stuff to non-hospitalized care. And so if we can get better at creating, you know, outpatient urgent care clinics where you go in for very simple things, get swabs, see it's strep, get antibiotics, that avoids a trip to the emergency room. And my hope is that going forward, we learn some of the lessons we learned during the pandemic and try to see and create these a little bit more creative solutions to save and be a little bit more efficient with some of our healthcare resources.
Thanks, Dr. Labos.
My pleasure. You take care.
Dr. Christopher Labos, who's a cardiologist and a medical writer with a degree in epidemiology. 419. Coming up, is there such a thing as a natural Ozempic, the diabetes drug that stops you from feeling as hungry, stops the cravings, makes people lose weight? That's what a lot of celebrities are using it as. It's an off-label use. It was originally intended to help people with diabetes. Is there such a thing that you could walk into a pharmacy and just pick up a supplement without a prescription? We'll find out if it's a myth or if there's any truth to it on the other side.
On News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
And I noticed that if I take berberine and then eat something either full of fat or greasy or just that is not in alignment with healthy food, it hurts my stomach. So it's almost like it's teaching you not to eat like that because you're going to get an upset stomach if you eat like that. So it does go with eating healthy and with working out that you are more than likely to see some type of result with the supplement is what I found for myself.
That's TikToker Savannah, also known as Being Sav, talking about her 8-week journey using berberine. Welcome back to Ottawa Now. Good to have you along for the ride today. Ozempic, the injectable diabetes medication, has become so popular. It's huge. Everybody's talking about it as a weight loss drug. And the appetite for Ozempic now is so big that people have been posting about alternatives from cheaper generic Ozempic to other diabetic drugs like Mounjaro. Now there's a TikTok craze over something new, a supplement called berberine. It's what some TikTokers are calling nature's Ozempic. So many people are posting about it, claiming that it's a cheaper option, that you can get it at pharmacies. But what is berberine? And is there actually any evidence to support this? Dr. Mitch Shulman joins us now on the line. He's an emergency medicine specialist at McGill University Health Center and the Bell Media medical consultant. Hi, doctor.
Howdy, and thank you for having me on. When these things happen, it is so nice to have the opportunity to kind of give people a proper perspective. Whether they listen or not, I leave up to them, but at least they'll have the facts.
What the heck is berberine?
And I think that's it, exactly. What the bleep is it? It's a quote-unquote natural substance. Obviously, it has to be better than anything else. That comes from, you find it in turmeric and things like that. It comes from the barberry shrub and some other bushy plants. It's actually been used for a very long time in alternative medicines, Chinese and Ayurvedic and other forms of alternative medicine. And there is some scientific literature on it, basically using it as a metformin-like drug. In English, metformin is a commonly used medication that we use for diabetes. It turns out that this drug berberine may actually have some benefits in terms of being able to control blood sugar and some of the other beneficial effects, a lot like metformin. The problem is, in the studies using it in this way, over a third of the patients using the berberine complained of tummy problems, nausea, vomiting, and especially diarrhea. That seems to be a real problem with this medication. Now you have these people claiming it's going to cause weight loss. Well, there's no proof. It's not like semaglutide, which is the actual name for the glucagon-like peptide number one that goes by the trade name Ozempic and others. It doesn't work in the same way at all, number one. It's not a glucagon-like peptide 1 agonist in any way. It doesn't work in the same way. So let's go back a step. When you use Ozempic, when you use semaglutide or any of the medications like it, you're injecting something into your body that has been modified to last a long time. And what it basically does normally is, this is a hormone secreted by the stomach and the first parts of your intestine that tells you, hey, food's on the way, you're full, don't eat anymore. It also tells the pancreas to get ready, to use insulin properly, the whole bit. And that's why it may work as a weight loss medication. It's triggering the feeling of being full sooner than you might otherwise, and therefore probably helping you to reduce the amount that you eat. Well, berberine doesn't do that at all. Berberine may help control your sugar, certainly doesn't mimic this this messenger from your tummy, certainly doesn't go to your brain and do the same thing. If it causes any weight loss, maybe it's because of the diarrhea or because you feel so sick to your stomach you don't eat. And I don't think that's a great way to lose weight. And even in those circumstances where it's caused weight loss, it's minuscule amounts. You're talking about maybe 4% of your weight. When you're looking at something like semaglutide, you're looking at 12% of body weight, a really significant difference. So to cut to the chase, berberine, not safe. It's not regulated because it's a dietary supplement. You have no idea what you're getting and how good it is. Has all sorts of nasty side effects, interacts with all sorts of drugs, and doesn't really cause you to lose weight. So if you want to use it, it's not safe, it's not regulated, you don't know what you're taking, and it's going to cause diarrhea. Really? Is that what you want to do?
Bottom line, berberine is not the same as Ozempic at all. The thing is, doctor, some people might turn to this supplement because they're desperate to lose weight. They can't get their hands on an Ozempic prescription, or they can't find Ozempic. Beyond the upset stomach, the diarrhea, if you're pounding back berberine and you're on another prescription, you have a medication that's been prescribed to you by a doctor, are there any dangerous interactions with that?
Yes, without question. So it interferes with the metabolism of all sorts of other drugs and gets you into problems. So if you're on a medication for high blood pressure, for cholesterol, for any of these indications, it could get you into trouble in interaction with those medications because of its interference with the metabolism of these drugs. And I mean significantly, not something you can predict, not something you can take care of, something you have to be afraid of.
What would you say to people out there right now that are curious about these supplements? And there's so many of them beyond berberine. I see them at the pharmacy all the time, these weight loss pills. You have no idea what's in them. What advice would you offer people that are curious about them in general?
People are going to hate me. I apologize. There's no one pill that's going to get you to lose weight safely, regularly and reasonably. Even semaglutide and all these medications, they have side effects. There's the possibility of pancreatitis, which is inflammation of your pancreas. There's a possibility of thyroid tumors. There's all sorts of things that you can get with these things. I hate to be a killjoy, but the only way to lose weight is portion control, limiting what you're eating, being wise about what you're eating, exercising, and it's a gradual process. And even for the people that are using the semaglutide and the semaglutide-like drugs, that means you're on it for the rest of your life. Because as soon as you stop it, you're going to put the weight right back on. And so, unfortunately, I wish there was a magic bullet. I really, really do, because I'd like people to feel better about themselves. I know a lot of people feel shamed and failure. I can't lose weight. There's something wrong with me. I'm just not a good person. And I understand all those feelings. Unfortunately, a pill ain't going to do it. Or an injection, by the way. Semaglutide's by injection. So no pill, no injection is going to do it. It may help in the short term, yes. But long term, you really have to look at modifying your lifestyle, expecting things to take time. Bariatric surgery does work, but I know it's tough to get. and Ozempic, semaglutide, all those drugs do help with blood sugar control if you're diabetic, and that's a reasonable and legitimate benefit from those medications. If you have really significant weight gain, and you really do have to lose the weight because it's causing joint problems or blood pressure problems or sugar problems or other problems, then a medication like semaglutide or any of that family of medications may be right for you, and then you need to have a long talk with your doctor, realize what you're getting into, and do it properly. And there really might be a benefit under those circumstances. But if you're trying to fit into your bikini for the summer, this is not the way to go.
Ozempic has been advertised and touted on the internet as this miracle diet drug, and people are so fixated on it, they're obsessed with it. I wonder if this will die down, if this is something that we'll look back on and laugh, or if this is something that will continue. What do you think?
You'll move on to the next miracle. That's what happens.
Something
right,
else that only... we find off-label, an off-label
right.
use for a different drug.
It'll be something completely different. It'll be some quote-unquote natural product. There's a hunger, which I understand, for something that's simple and that's easy and that will help you. I get it. It makes perfect sense. Right now, there's nothing like that really out there. For someone who wants to lose 5 or 10 pounds of weight, there is nothing out there other than portion control, diet, proper, you know, eating properly, eating intelligently, not, you know, not killing yourself, exercise to keep you in shape, and good sleep and all those other things. All those things help with weight loss, and they're good for long-term weight loss, and they'll maintain you in a healthy place. But this will die down. These things always do, right? You get that's a flash in the pan. It's perpetuated by social media, unfortunately, and by quote-unquote experts who aren't. And then it fades away, and everyone goes, well, whatever happened to so-and-so? And they are amazed that anyone could have believed that that would have been the big difference. And then a few years later, or a few months or a few weeks, there's something new.
Thanks for this, doctor. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. You guys have a great day and a great weekend.
Dr. Mitch Shulman, who's an emergency medicine specialist at McGill University Health Center. We'll be right back on Ottawa Now.
Welcome back to Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
So I'll keep dancing with my 440, welcome back. Air Canada appears to be walking back a decision to deny some passengers compensation. On May the 25th, you may remember that day, especially if you were traveling, Air Canada had to delay more than half of its flights due to a technical issue with the system that they used to communicate with the aircraft and to monitor the performance. Then again, on June the 1st, they had some issues where they delayed or canceled more than 500 flights, over three quarters of the trips that day. Initially, when passengers were complaining, in a message they sent to them, they said, listen, it's IT. It's out of our hands. So as a result, we don't have to pay compensation. They said, this is now a mistake. The rejection that they delivered, saying compensation claim from thousands of travelers wouldn't be given out, they said it was a mistake, and they're actually walking that back now. Duncan D joins me on the show, former chief operating officer at Air Canada. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to get you on the show. In fact, when we reached out to you today, it looked like they were still denying compensation, and that changed. What do you think happened here?
I think that, several things could happen. One was that they were basically dismissing these claims out of hand because they had policies in place to do so. So that wouldn't be a great thing. But obviously, after some individuals within the company looked at the situation, they decided that doing so would be wrong. And it was clearly wrong. This is something that they have acknowledged. They did acknowledge well before the claims were even received that was a situation which they had responsibility for. So, you know, for one hand to do one thing and the other hand not to know about it is a little bit disconcerting. But I think they walked it back pretty quickly from the time that the original story came out to the time they issued the correction. I think that the initial confusion lasted probably a little over an hour.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is an interesting thing to have passengers going to the airline to be complaining about their experience and then to see where the airline draws the line for compensation and how they interpret it. Like, I'm looking at an email here to one passenger. This is a passenger who said he arrived more than 3 hours late because his June 1st flight from Winnipeg to Toronto was delayed due to the IT defect. And he took great offense to the denial of his compensation. Right? Because, like, to him, this is about a goodwill gesture. This is about rewarding a customer that is loyal to Air Canada. To them, they have to look at all of the regulations and they have to draw their own conclusions, essentially, Duncan.
Yeah, and this customer is 100% right. I mean, I was at the airport on the 25th when the first outage took place, and I saw with my own eyes the number of travelers that were scrambling because of the delays that were caused. And so, you know, I think that, and, you know, again, the operating announcements that Air Canada was making on that day at the airports would have encouraged travelers like this one to actually file a claim. You know, they were the ones who were saying, you know, we're going to take care of you and, you know, please stand by and we're going to help rebook you. And, you know, they set up actually quite a robust response at the airports to help travelers. And so for this to have happened afterwards is really a head scratcher. Like, why would the initial communications not carry through to when it came to pay up, you know, when it came time for Air Canada to do good by its travelers? But again, I think that they've now decided that what they initially responded to some of these travelers that were impacted was wrong, and they needed to correct it quickly.
Yes, and they say when they were contacted by the Canadian press today that the initial response was erroneous, that it was a mistake, and the passengers that got those responses will be recontacted with the correct response. What do they need to be offered?
Look, I mean, there are tables in terms of what the compensation levels are. It depends on very numerous factors, from the amount of delay itself. So if it was an hour-long delay, it would be one amount. If it was a 3 or 4 hour-long delay, it'd be a different amount. But Christy, there's also travelers who were delayed mid-travel. So people who were connecting, for example, and missed their connection. Some people would have had to take a flight possibly later in the evening, missing their entire day or the next day. A lot of the outages that took place happened mid-morning Eastern time on the 25th, which would have meant that by the time things recovered, which they started to recover at around 1 p.m. that day, you basically wiped out your entire morning operation, which meant a lot of people who were trying to get out to their destinations throughout the morning would have been impacted, meaning many of them would have had to wait nearly a full day to get to where they needed to go. So, you know, it's hard to give you a specific number, but I would say the ballpark in terms of compensation would be in the several hundred to low $1,000s, depending on what people had to incur because of the situation caused by this IT outage. So some people may have had to, for example, book a hotel room, which they never expected they had to. So those are things that they would have to include in their claim with Air Canada. And so, you know, the number one advice to these travelers is keep your receipts and make sure that you have everything in place so that you can get compensated quickly and accurately.
Smart advice from Duncan D. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Christy.
Duncan D., who's the former chief operating officer at Air Canada. It's 4:47. We'll take a short break. On the other side, parents begging the Ottawa-Carleton District School Board not to cut a summer program for children with developmental delays. It is apparently being discussed right now because of the budget shortfall. We already heard from the chair of the school board. We'll hear from a parent next. Baby, show me you can calm down, calm
down. Dance with me and take the lead now. This is Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
My personal position is that we need to do everything we can for students with disabilities, particularly
students with high needs autism. It's a group of parents who already go through so much to have to come out and advocate and defend this program year over year. I think it's disappointing. However, that said, we are in a budget shortfall. We are not funded by the ministry to run this program. It comes entirely out of pocket, and we overspend on the special education envelope year over year over year.
That is the chair of Ottawa's largest school board, Lyra Evans, talking about a summer learning program that is available to students at that board with complex developmental disabilities and autism. It is a program that acts as a bit of a bridge between the school year through the summer. It's a 17-day summer learning program that has been available for students, but it may be on the chopping block. Trustees at the Ottawa-Carleton District School Board are grappling with this money shortfall, and they have to somehow chop $19 million from the board's budget by the end of this month. They've discussed a bunch of proposals. One of the things that is being looked at is this summer learning program. And the parents and the students that are part of this have spoken up. The families have come forward saying how important it is, imploring the board not to make cuts to this program. And I have one of the family members right now on the line, the mother of a 14-year-old student who takes part in this, Françoise Sloan-White. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you first learn this was being considered?
Well, I learned about it through another parent who was alerted to the fact that the summer learning program was identified in the budget proposal as a cut through her trustee. So we really appreciated that heads up. And that's how I've known since Thursday.
What does this summer learning program mean to you?
For me, it provides the continuity that my daughter needs. It gives her that extra month, basically, of a school environment and continuation in her work of learning new skills and working on the goals that she works on through the school year. It gives her like a 1 month extension on that. And then it's only 1 month, August, where she doesn't, you know, she doesn't have that routine and that learning environment. But that 1 month in July ties her over to September. So in September, she's not starting all over again.
Mm-hmm. What would it mean for you if this program was no longer available?
Well, it would mean that she would definitely regress, and she would lose some skills. And when she comes back in September, she'll have to relearn a lot of routines, and really, it'll be a step backwards for her. And when I see the amount of progress that she makes through the school year, it would just be really disappointing to see her fall back and then have to restart.
And you heard my conversation a little bit there with Lyra Evans. Lyra told me she sees the value in this. She supports the program. But unfortunately, that this is a tough decision they're being faced with, that they've got a lot of different parts they need to consider. $19 million needs to come out of the budget. And that this program is, while quite unique and very beneficial, it is expensive and it's difficult to staff. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I acknowledge that it is an expensive program, and we've heard that it's difficult to staff. To us, like, it's worth the investment. I mean, this is for kids who really need that continuity to reach their potential. And, you know, we appreciate that the board has been funding this program for many years now. And it's disappointing that there's eight other summer school programs that the board runs, and they're all funded by the ministry. We're the only summer school program that isn't funded by the ministry. So that's really disappointing as well.
Is there any alternative here if this program is cut, which would be very difficult for you and your family, that you can turn to? Do you have any other options?
Well, there are no other educational programs available that we can put our kids in during the summer. There are, I mean, for the level of needs that these kids have, there's maybe one, maybe two possible like respite programs, but those are more recreational. So they're not going to have the routines that are anything like school. They're not going to have any kind of educational value. They're not going to have the benefits that the summer learning program offers.
Françoise, I appreciate you coming on the show today. We'll stay in touch.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Françoise Slon-White, the mother of a 14-year-old student who takes part in that program. It's 17 days. It is very unique. As I said, this is a summer learning program that is not offered in other parts of Ontario, which is why the parents cherish it so much, because they say it's so valuable to them. But unlike some of the legislated programs, the funding, the school board says, is not within their envelope. That is the school board's description of it. They have other programs that for different groups that are funded through special purpose grants, programs that are defined by the province. This is something that is outside of those programs, meaning that it's potentially on the chopping block. A decision has to be made by the end of this month of where that $19 million in the OCDSB budget will come from. 5 p.m., we'll take a short break. Your question of the day coming up next.